The Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Ross, Judge Johnson, Judge Kirk, the Honorable Kevin G. Ross presiding.
Good morning and welcome to this panel of the Court of Appeals, December 16, 2021. This is our second argument today in our oral calendar. The case is Frazin versus Frazin. And counsel, each of you will have 15 minutes to present your argument with an additional 5 minutes to appellant's counsel if you choose to use it. So far, we've been managing pretty well under the technology, but in the last few days, I think there have been some glitches. So if you, for at any time, have any difficulty seeing or hearing anyone, just try to let us know and we'll pause the proceedings so that we can hopefully get the technology back in order. Even though we can see each other and read each other's names, we are only making an audio, not a video recording of the proceedings. So please state your name as you commence each leg of your argument. Counsel for appellant, whenever you are ready to proceed, you may.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, counsel, my name is Bo McGraw, and it's my pleasure to represent the appellant, Joshua Frazin, in this appeal. This appeal stems from a district court order dated December 20, 2020, in the Washington County District Court. The crux of the appeal is that this was one of those cases where we are right at the front end of the pandemic. It's a disillusion case. It involves minor children. It involves significant issues of property. It's a 10-year marriage, Your Honors. What happened is the case was set for trial on March 16th. My client at that time was a pro se litigant. And the first day of trial commenced, I would note that the petitioner, who was represented by counsel, Ms. Graves, because she was the petitioner, got to go first that day. And it looks to me from the transcript that most of that day was eaten up with the testimony from the petitioner's case. And what happened at the conclusion of that case is the court said, we can't take it all in on one day. And we're going to come back for a second day, which is typical in disillusion cases. That second day was set for April 23, 2020. In the meantime, the pandemic hit, and Chief Judge Gildea issued an order in March of 2020, providing some directive to the district court. And in relevant part, this order provided as follows. District courts, Ms. Justice Gildea explicitly directed district courts to hold such...
Because we're all aware of the orders in place, and you only have 15 minutes, you might want to jump right into the legal issues that we have. I'm pretty sure we're all apprised of the factual and procedural background.
I appreciate that, Your Honor. Your Honor, my legal position.
If I may, Mr. McGraw, before you get into the legal issues, I'd like a better understanding of the procedural history. So after the first day of the trial, thinking ahead to the second day, which witnesses or what testimony was your client intending to introduce into evidence? Which witnesses was he intending to call in the courtroom, but was then unable to do so?
I don't know for certain, but what I anticipated his testimony would be that he was going to provide significant testimony himself. He was going to have family members testify about his relationship with the children, his ability to provide safe care. And then, as the court is aware, based upon the briefing, he wanted to provide testimony of the custody evaluators that did the evaluation on this case. So he anticipated.
I understand from the record that he did testify at the first day, and I got the sense from the record, but it's unclear to me, that he had finished his direct examination or his own evidence, and then what was left for the second day was cross-examination by opposing counsel. Is that accurate?
That would have been accurate, I think, Your Honor. But he didn't rest at any point, and he had the ability to adjust to determine what evidence he wanted to provide that second day, because that first day was largely eaten up by the testimony of the petitioner's case. So he anticipated a whole nother day here. And what happened is the court said, we're not going to have another day of trial. I'm going to go ahead and instruct you to provide me with additional testimony or evidence via depositions. And it's our position that that falls short and his due process rights were not vindicated. And I want to walk through a little bit of that because that's the crux of this case.
Well, before you do, I want to get a sense of when the argument was presented for consideration. So did your client ever raise any concern? The three concerns that you're raising on appeal, as I understand it, are that your client that this deposition process would have required your client to incur significant cost above his means, that he lacked the knowledge, and that there wasn't sufficient time from that June hearing to July 28th, I guess it's a bit over a month, June 18th to July 29th, 24th, I think, to have completed the depositions. So when was the first time your client raised that issue?
He objected to the court's order. The court directed the parties to proceed in this fashion on July 18th. And the court said it's all got to be completed, June 18th, and it all has to be completed by July 24th. My client objected right at that time and said that I can't proceed in this fashion. And then the court held ruling on that objection all the way up to July 8th. So the court rules on July 8th, everything's got to be completed by July 24th. That's the chronology on that piece of it. He objected right away. Well, he said, I'm not able to accomplish these depositions.
Okay, so I'm not able to accomplish the depositions. Did he say that cost or knowledge or time were an issue? And in consistent with that, am I correct that the district court offered, if there was a request for additional time would be provided, and that your client did not make a request for additional time? Correct me if I'm wrong about any of that.
I don't have his objection in front of me, but I do think that in his objection, he highlighted some of the same concerns that we've highlighted on appeal. I believe you are correct in that the district court said if additional time was requested, it would be considered. I believe that. Your Honor, here's my concern.
Am I correct that he did not request additional time despite the offer by the district court?
You are correct, Your Honor. Okay. He continued to maintain his objection that he believed that the process was not fundamentally fair and didn't vindicate his due process rights.
I understand that. But I understand that's the argument too on appeal, which we'll get to in a moment. But I just wanted to get a sense of whether he had ever raised the question of cost or knowledge. As to knowledge, do you agree with me that the rules are pretty clear, the case law is clear, that whether you're represented or not, the same rules will apply to you and the same procedure will apply if you choose to go forward without counsel?
Yeah, I agree with that generally. I just have never found a case, and I looked long and hard when I was preparing this appeal, where a court suspended regular trial proceedings and directed parties to proceed through a kind of complex discovery process. And here's another thing to think about here. So think of this. The Supreme Court suspended live hearings during this time period. Yet this judge directed these parties to participate in depositions. Where are the findings in the judge's order that says that was even feasible? I have a fairly robust practice that expands beyond family law. I went back to my calendar this morning and looked to see whether or not I was taking any remote depositions in June, July, August of 2020. I couldn't find a single one. I wasn't taking remote depositions up until much later in that year and in the first part of 2021. So what I would have liked to have seen in this order is some direction to the parties as to how and whether or not it was even feasible to do depositions. Here's another thing to think about.
Well, it's an interesting argument, but your argument isn't based upon any mere technical rule. Your argument is based upon as I read your brief, the state and federal constitutional right to due process. And I didn't see any case law supporting your proposition that the Constitution, either state or federal, that the due process provision prohibits a district court from changing from live proceedings to online proceedings, whether or not there's a pandemic.
Yeah, and I think the same could be true. There's no case that allows the court to direct the parties to proceed in this fashion. And there's no case that then says that an individual's due process rights have been vindicated.
What's the closest case you could find to suggest that switching to a deposition process impinges upon or raises any due process concerns at all?
Yeah. So the closest case that I could find, the only one that even touches this one, I cited on page 10 of my brief, and it's the Ertl versus Ertl case. where the court made a determination about the way a party's retirement account was to be divided. And it was done in a way where there wasn't a live hearing and there wasn't opportunities to contest that part of the evidence.
Well, that's the second part. The second part is the problem with your argument. There was a sua sponte issue in that case. It was directed at one party and there wasn't an opportunity to respond. I mean, due process, basic due process 101 is notice and the opportunity to be heard. In that case, there was not the opportunity to be heard. In this case, it seems like, even though you say the Ertl case hits this case on all fours, I'm not seeing that. I have to be honest.
I hope that I didn't misrepresent my feelings about that case. I don't think there's any case that hits this case on all fours.
In fairness to you, you didn't say that. You said it was similar to this case. I don't see the similarity. So maybe you can disabuse me of my hesitancy to jump into your argument.
Yeah, I think it's an introduction to the issues that we see in this case. I think this issue might almost be one of first impression. There's not a case, and counsel for the respondent's not going to be able to cite to a single case that says that a person's due process rights have been vindicated based upon this procedure that's administered by the court. But I want to go back beyond the case law a little bit. If you want to direct me back, this is your time and I'll go back. But I want the court to understand some of the practical realities of what we're dealing with here. I deal with clients day in, day out. This is what we had. We had an individual that was going to try this case himself. A very difficult process, but something, he's not entitled to a lawyer. I agree with that. That's not a due process right that he was entitled to here. If he elected to proceed, he could himself. Folks in our system of justice try cases all the time by themselves. They do that of their own free will. But for the court to direct them away from that path and go away from the Supreme Court order, quite frankly, and not order the parties to participate in a Zoom or similar related hearing and instruct them to proceed down this deposition road does not vindicate his due process rights. First of all, I'm not sure it even could have happened. Think in terms of a pro se litigant that doesn't have an office. How is he going to organize people to come in around a conference room and take a deposition? He has to contact the deposition company. They may or may not have been doing remote depositions at the time. My evidence on my calendar suggests that they weren't. That took some time for them to get up to speed, just like it took the court. The court puts an abbreviated schedule in place. My client timely objects to the process. And then he's expected to organize depositions, take depositions, provide transcript. Here's the other safeguard that I think the court should consider. In live testimony where the judge is present when the testimony is coming in, that judge has an opportunity to guide the parties a tad as to what's relevant and what's not. And sometimes, I've tried cases against pro se litigants, sometimes judges have asserted themselves to protect the evidentiary rights of pro se litigants, knowing that the attorney has a significant advantage in that space. I participated in that. That could have happened here if Mr. Friesen proceeded in front of the judge presenting this case. In a deposition setting, never going to happen. Ms. Graves has a significant advantage in that environment, and he won't know what's reasonable to object to and what's not.
It sounds like you're objecting to a possible harm that might have occurred in a deposition that never happened.
I'm objecting to the entire process of the court directing. What I'm trying to do is I'm trying to highlight what the harms are if because of the court's directive and what that looks like. And for this court to determine,
it's possible. You maybe have a better straightforward argument than the hypothetical one you're making now, because it seems to me that if your client had these concerns and raised them with the district court, the district court might have had an opportunity to say, well, Mr. Friesen, here's some avenues you can go down to figure out how to take a deposition. You know, I'm a judge. I can't direct you, but there are opportunities for you to learn how to do it. You could ask for more time. And none of this was raised by your client. So I guess that, again, goes back to the concern I've got. You're raising a due process challenge way after the fact, and there could have been opportunities for any of the harms that you're suggesting to have been completely mitigated had your client actually expressed the three issues that you say now on appeal are the basis for your due process concern: cost, knowledge, and timeliness.
he did object generally to the process, Your Honor. Again, we have to understand that this is a pro se litigant. He's not going to, and he did a really nice job objecting to this, and I give him great credit for that, but it's different than the way I would have objected, or Ms. Graves would have objected, or somebody else. Here's the other point I want to raise just before we conclude here, because I know I'm down to about 50 seconds, is that this court directed the parties to go ahead and get a custody and parenting time evaluation, which is common in these cases. It comes at great expense. My client went ahead and did that. The parties agreed that this individual is going to be an impartial third party. This individual came back, made a determination that it would be in the children's best interest for joint legal and joint physical custody. The court refused to accept that report. Think in terms of this. This judge thought that it was okay.
Let me pause you before you get too deep into this, because I don't think you cited in your brief. Which rule of evidence did the district court violate by not allowing the report to come in without foundation?
The district court did not violate any law. That evidence doesn't come in under normal circumstances without appropriate foundation. The problem I have with it here is this judge determined what rules were okay to bend and what rules weren't. Due process fell by the wayside. Evidentiary rules were upheld. And that's not fair to Mr. Friesen. And here's the other point about the custody and parenting time evaluation. That shows the harm in this ruling. That independent third party who was in the best position to determine what was in the best interest of these children determined joint legal, joint physical custody. I'm out of time.
But you will have 5 minutes of rebuttal time.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Now, I just want, before I let you escape, I want to see if either Judge Johnson or Judge Kirk had any questions they wanted to ask before you for the break. Okay, very good. On to Respondents' Counsel.
Thank you, Your Honor. My name is Catherine Graves. I am the attorney representing the respondent in this matter, Michelle Friesen. We're asking the court to deny the appeal and to affirm the November 2020 judgment and decree in all respects. I wanted to respond to a question that Judge Johnson had for opposing counsel as far as what evidence Mr. Friesen was not able to get in. What he was denied was the opportunity to be cross-examined by me. And based on his witness list, I think he had one or two family members who were also going to be testifying. And he wasn't denied. He simply chose not to follow the procedure that the court had allowed. There is no due process violation, Your Honor. I think in looking at the parties' briefs, we agree on what the components of due process are. And that includes an opportunity for a hearing and an opportunity to present evidence. And clearly the deposition process, which allows you to bring in testimony, exhibits, and to present evidence, allows for that process. We've cited in our brief the case of Rue versus Bergstrom at 845 Northwest 2nd 764, where the court made it clear that there is no guarantee, certainly in a civil case such as this one, that in-person testimony is always going to be available.
Ms. Graves?
Yes.
I wanted to jump to the second part of Mr. McGraw's argument on behalf of Mr. Friesen. There was certainly a change in the procedure that is something less than an in-person proceeding. There are many court proceedings that or administrative proceedings where the rules of evidence are relaxed. And it seems to me a plausible argument that under circumstances such as these, the foundation issue for the evidentiary the custody evaluator's report to come in might have been something the court could have overlooked in this case. It didn't seem to be one where there was any real doubt as to foundation, as to who wrote the report. After all, it was the judge, I believe, who had asked for the report. Am I correct?
Correct.
So,
well, actually, Mr. Friesen had asked for it, and
right, but the court had authorized.
But he had ordered it. Yes.
Right. So I was struck by it. It surprised me when I read the record that the district court didn't simply allow the report to come in, recognizing that there may not have been an opportunity because there's no deposition for your client to have cross-examined the evaluator. It seems to be, at least for some evidentiary benefit, the report could have been allowed in. Can you address that, and specifically as it regards due process?
Yes, Your Honor. The main point is that Minnesota Statute 518.167 Subdivision 3 allows the court to admit that report, but only if the party has an opportunity to cross-examine. In this case, I was not given the opportunity to cross-examine the authors of that report. And I would like to point out that Mr. Friesen was given three opportunities to have that report properly admitted. And he ignored it because he, for whatever reason, didn't want to follow the rules or didn't want to follow the guidelines of the court.
Well, when you say didn't want to follow, I because of a prior profession, I knew something about depositions before I went to law school, but I would suggest most people have no idea what a deposition is unless they've actually gone through law school or have some significant relationship to the legal process. So when you say you had prior opportunities, I'm assuming you're referring to the opportunities to have deposed the creators of the report.
Well, in addition to that, Your Honor, prior to trial, Mr. Friesen could have and should have asked the custody evaluators to prepare a written report, which he then could have submitted, and then he should have made arrangements for the custody evaluators to be present on the first day of trial. And then all of that part of the trial, then that information could have been, he knew about it ahead of time.
Well, perhaps, but he didn't know. I don't think anybody would have known before the first day of trial that the trial was going to be bifurcated and part of the trial would not be live.
Right. And I would just note that there are some judges who wouldn't have allowed it because there wasn't a pretrial order and we were required to identify witnesses and exhibit lists in advance. Mr. Friesen never identified the custody evaluators as either as an exhibit or as potential witnesses. So I wouldn't have had any prior notice of that. But the judge gave him two more chances, Your Honor. We had a second day of trial that was initially scheduled. At the conclusion of the first day of trial, Judge Hoffman, to his credit, was very detailed with Mr. Friesen what he needed to do in order to be able to get that evidence into the court record. That, unfortunately, that hearing didn't take place, but the opportunity for depositions was given. And as I can't remember if it was you, Judge Ross, but one of the panel members noted, he could have asked for additional time for the scheduling of the depositions. And I think it's also important to remember that Mr. Friesen had previously hired two lawyers. He had the financial ability to hire a lawyer. He makes over $150,000 a year. He chose not to. And he could have, at a minimum, consulted with an attorney and sought some assistance about how do I get a deposition scheduled. Yeah, it was more challenging last summer. I don't think any of us will deny that. Everything was more challenging for the court. But Mr. Friesen had that opportunity. He never asked the court for additional time. He chose not to follow 518.167 when he had clear notice of what it was supposed to do. And the other thing that he did do is he filed the custody evaluation, even though the court had told him that he's not supposed to file it unless, you know, it wouldn't be admitted as an exhibit unless I was given the opportunity to cross-examine the evaluators. Because there were things that happened, Your Honor, and I don't know that it's a part of the record before you, but it was before the trial court. There were things that happened between the first day of trial and July that were a part of what the court was deciding. And, you know, had I had the opportunity to cross-examine the custody evaluators, that would have been an issue.
Ms. Graves, to be clear then about what Mr. Friesen could have and should have done after the first day of trial, I think in order to get the custody evaluation report into evidence, I think it's your position that he could have and should have noticed the depositions of one or both of the authors, and then had it gotten the foundation for the document, then allowed you to cross-examine, and then the deposition transcript and the report could have been submitted to the court.
Yes. That. Yes, that is the process he should have followed. And I do believe that Mr. Friesen works from home. He's well acquainted with remote technology. I believe he would have had the ability to do that.
Is there anything in the record about his? I mean, I share Judge Ross's concerns about most non-lawyers might not be familiar with what a deposition is, let alone able to have the know-how to set it up and to conduct it. But is there anything in the record that indicates that Mr. Friesen had some greater knowledge or ability than most people to do that?
No, Your Honor, I don't think so. But he did represent himself at trial, and he did submit.
But it's it's easier, much easier for a non-lawyer just to show up at the courthouse and then speak, be prepared to speak and to answer questions. But to set up a deposition, I mean, most lawyers rely upon non-lawyer staff and office facilities and other things in order to make that happen, as we know. I have a question. Well, go ahead and
you can. No, I was just going to say I agree with you. I agree on as far as the scheduling.
I guess I have a question about the first issue, and the appellant's counsel has presented it as a due process issue, and so we must consider it that way. I have a question in my mind about whether the procedure is authorized by the rules of civil procedure or by any other rule of court. I don't know if you've looked at that, and I'm not sure if that is relevant to our analysis or not, but I mean, trial depots usually are, I mean, they're offered by a party, and then the district judge, there might be an objection, district judge determines whether they may be admitted, but it's the first case I've seen where the district court says you must try the case with trial depots, from this point forward. But is there any rule in the rules of civil procedure or elsewhere that specifically authorizes that?
I'm not aware of one, Your Honor. I would assume that Judge Hoffman was doing what we were all doing last summer, which was trying to figure out how do we get cases tried within a reasonable amount of time. And but again, since we, you know, the rules do allow trial depositions to be submitted, it certainly would be something that would be, I'm not aware of any rule that says you can't do that. And again, I think what's important is that one factor to consider is that Mr. Friesen has never identified what evidence he didn't get in, except for perhaps the custody evaluation that would have otherwise been submitted to the court. He never explained that, and he never explained, well, why didn't he ask for additional time? And again, we do cite a case in our brief, Your Honor, about, you know, because Mr. McGraw is making a big issue of the fact that that his client was pro se and that he should have been given more leeway in what was by the court. But there's a case, Grunhagen versus Larson, 246 Northwest 2nd. It's a 45-year-old case. But it basically says that if someone chooses to represent themselves voluntarily, and clearly Mr. Friesen made that choice, he should not be permitted to insist that the courts modify their ordinary rules and procedures because he lacked the skills and knowledge of a lawyer. That's what Mr. Friesen is asking this court to do. He took the risk by choosing to represent himself. He could have simply made a call to one of his former lawyers and to set up a deposition. There's no evidence he was incapable of doing that. He did receive due process of law. Again, I would note on the issue of the custody evaluation that it would have been reversible error if Judge Hoffman had allowed that report to go in without giving me an opportunity to cross-examine the custody evaluators, because 518.167 is very clear on what it requires. And I've been doing family law for many years. I've never seen a judge deviate from that.
Well, the court could have tentatively allowed the report to come in and given you leave to depose the witnesses to challenge either foundation or substance. So I'm not under the circumstances, under the unique developing circumstances of how do you respond to the pandemic and not being able to go to the courthouse. I'm not that persuaded by your position that this was the only option for the district court.
Well, I think the court, I mean, I understand that procedurally it could have been done differently, Your Honor, but the fact is that it was not, and Mr. Friesen never asked the court to do that. He never asked the court to please, you know, accept this, and then if Ms. Graves wants to cross-examine the custody evaluators, to give her leave to do so. That was never requested of the trial court. He just said, I want to be in court. I don't want to have to go through depositions. That's the only relief he asked from the court. I can say that had that opportunity been, if the court had done that, I most certainly would have asked to cross-examine those witnesses. But Mr. Friesen never requested it. And now he's coming back a year or two later and asking the court to try, this court, to try to make up for and to give him relief that he never requested.
How would it have worked practically, and maybe you've already answered this to some extent when you responded to Judge Johnson's question, but how would it work practically speaking for a pro se individual before there was Zoom operating as a matter of course? How would that have worked? How would he have actually proceeded with depositions, assuming he has no office?
Well, you don't need an office in order to do a deposition. With the remote depositions, we do them just like we are here.
I thought that if I understood the process, and I'd have to go back and look, that at that stage, Zoom proceedings weren't yet the norm in all of the district courts. Am I correct
That's correct, Your Honor.
So assuming that he... like most of us who had no idea, I never even heard of Zoom until I was told we were going to be having hearings by Zoom. And I'm imagining that most people are in that situation, especially folks that aren't usually in a business setting. So how would that practically work for someone who's not familiar with Zoom? The court doesn't say, here's an option for you. We've got Zoom available through the court system. How would that work practically speaking?
Well, I would assume that he would have contacted a court reporter, and the court reporter could have told Mr. Friesen what the process was at the time that they were using, and then the remote deposition could have taken place just as we're doing now, and a transcript is prepared, and the transcript would have then been submitted to the court. That's how the video depositions were being done. And I will reiterate that Mr. Friesen is an IT person. He works from home. So he did have the ability, he wasn't like a lot of our clients who only have their cell phone. So again, Your Honor, we're asking that the appeal be denied. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Graves. Oh, Ms. sorry, Judge Johnson.
Yeah, may I ask one more question?
Yes.
That is, Ms. Graves, at the at trial, I guess, were there any issues other than custody and parenting time that were in dispute, or was that the sole item to be resolved by the district court?
No, there were child support, the amount of child support, and the property division. The parties own the house. The court had to decide what to do with that. So property, pretty much everything except for spousal maintenance was at issue.
Thank you.
Thank you. Any other questions by Judge Kirk?
Just one quick one. Counsel, you know, it seems like Judge Hoffman in his findings and order made it very clear that it really didn't matter what the custody evaluators may have said, that he was not going to order joint physical custody given the parties' inability to cooperate as might be necessary for that kind of an order. Does that give you some sense that you win regardless?
Yes. That was my observation and my impression as well, Your Honor. If you look through the transcript of the first day of trial, he did make a number of comments to that effect. So I don't know that the custody evaluation would have made any difference.
That's all I have.
Thank you.
Thank you. And thank you, Ms. Graves. Counsel for appellant.
Thank you, Your Honors. So I'm not going to cover the same ground unless I'm directed to. I'll try to respond to counsel's argument.
Well, just a little same ground. I'd like you to Okay. Remind you to state your name. I should begin.
I'm sorry, Your Honor. My name is Bo McGraw, and I represent Mr. Friesen, the appellant in these proceedings. Counsel cites a case in her brief, and she talked about it in her responsive argument about how the court should not depart from ordinary procedure to benefit pro se litigants. That's exactly what the court did here, did depart, but not for a pro se litigant's benefit, actually for a pro se litigant's detriment. And what counsel also fails to talk about on her argument is that she
I don't know if that's a fair characterization. I mean, it was everyone's out of concern for everyone at the time, believing that in-person hearings were dangerous. It affected everyone the same.
I agree with the public health risk 100%, Your Honor. But if you look at the judge's order, he didn't say you're supposed to now go take remote depositions. He said take depositions. Was he anticipating that they would sit around my client's kitchen table and take a deposition with a court reporter there? Because I'm not convinced, looking back on this, that depositions were occurring remotely at that time. And there's nothing about the court's order that says that part of the record could have been developed via remote depositions. But I'm not convinced they were happening.
Let me jump in here because when I read the district court's order as it relates to custody, I think I saw it as Ms. Grave saw it. The court is hyper-focused on the tension between the parties. You know, I don't know that every district court judge would have concluded the same as this district court as to how the tension results. You know, what are the legal conclusions from it, that mom gets sole custody or that there shouldn't be. I was a bit of a loss as to why parenting time should not be more equalized, since there's still going to be four transitions during the 14-day period. So I wasn't quite sure that the reasoning was supported, but that's not an issue that was raised, so I'm not going to go into it. But my point is the district court was focused on the tension between the parties and the relationship with the parties. And your client was able to testify during the first day of trial live, and so able to respond to Ms. Friesen or Ms. Friesen's testimony live. So it seems like, at least as it regards the focus of the district court and the basis of the district court's decision, that the live testimony was equally provided to the parties.
I believe that my client provided testimony, and I believe that the testimony my client provided supported his position that it was in the best interest for his minor children to have a joint legal and joint physical custody relationship. But to discount what the potential additional evidence would have been and the judge forming the conclusion that that wasn't in the best interest of the children, when the judge himself directed the parties to get an impartial third party, not one, but two involved, to make recommendations on custody and parenting time. And then for the judge to say that that would not have been persuasive in any way, he didn't have the second day of trial where that testimony would have been provided. So when Ms. Graves talks about there was nothing he wasn't able to submit, it was the single biggest piece of evidence. It's DNA in a criminal case.
I guess
it's
to put
DNA
a fine,
in a criminal case.
To fine point it, just so you can have another opportunity to persuade me, I will tell you what I'm sympathetic to the argument. I am. What my trouble is as a matter of evidentiary rules and as a matter of constitutional due process law, I don't know that you've made the case that what the district court did was a constitutional violation.
Your Honor, respectfully, I think you've answered your own question. You said to Ms. Graves, you said, what would the harm have been for this judge allowing this report to come in and instructing the lawyer to notice a deposition and cross-examine that witness if she disagreed with that report? That was the remedy that would have allowed for fundamental fairness to exist in these proceedings, and it didn't. I can't imagine family law cases where it's going to be okay to have them tried by paper. And think of the cost of this. Depositions are $1,000 a pop. And that's with lawyers muddling around. Imagine non-attorneys muddling around. They're $1,000 a pop. And it's not fair to say my client makes $150,000 a year, so he should be able to do this. That's nothing in a divorce case. He couldn't afford the two lawyers he had. That's why he didn't have a lawyer on the day of trial. He made a decision. I put my money in the custody evaluation because this court seems to be more persuaded by that independent third party. I can't do both. He didn't have $1,000 per deposition. He didn't have the means to do it. It's not fair to put this on a pro se litigant. We're asking that you reverse and remand this thing. What is the problem with going back for one day of trial? These kids at the time of this were 4 and 6. Let's get it right. It's not too much to ask. Thank you.
Counsel, one quick question.
Your Honor, thank you.
When the case was initially set, was the understanding it would be more than one day, or were the parties planning on handling the case on that day?
I don't know. I wasn't involved then. I know that at the conclusion of the first day, it was because they couldn't get through all the issues. The court did instruct the parties they will have another day. I know that was told for sure. My own experience, Ms. Graves, I'm sure would support this. This is a fairly complex dissolution proceeding. It doesn't finish in one day. And this judge would have been well aware of that.
But it seems like your client was given an opportunity to have presented the custody evaluation on that day if he'd had the witnesses there. And it doesn't seem like he'd made any arrangement for that. And if the case had wrapped up that day, they would not have been presented.
We know it didn't wrap up that day, so we'd be speculating. We know that if I'm a petitioner, I'm not going to pay a custody evaluator with the kind of money to go sit in a courthouse and wait for the potential after 8 hours to potentially testify, especially two custody evaluators. I think he made the right decision knowing Ms. Graves was going to put her client on. Then he would start to testify. That's going to take it through the day. The second day, then he knows his witnesses are going to be up front and center. He can have his custody evaluator, the impartial third party custody evaluator appointed by the court to go first.
You're aware of situations, I'm sure, and I haven't been on the trial court for 10 years, but it was common in the cases I tried where there was a custody evaluator for the evaluator to sit through the testimony as well. Was that just prohibited because of the cost in this case?
I haven't seen that for some time. I can't imagine a circumstance where a client can really afford that unless you're really significant means. It's probably at a minimum $3,500 to get an evaluation, then another couple grand to get a report, and then maybe $300 an hour to sit. These type of family scenarios, they have just enough money to live together. And when you're dividing that up, it's really cost prohibitive to have the luxuries of having witnesses sitting around a courthouse waiting to potentially testify. I would have noticed that witness for the second day, Your Honor. I would have got through the afternoon with my client. I would have had his mom on standby. It's exactly what he did. Here's the other thing I want to point out. He showed up. There was another day that was set for trial, and I'm out of time, so I'll stop as soon as I'm done with this. There was another day that was set for trial, and the judge gave the petitioner, Ms. Friesen, the benefit of a retrial because Ms. Friesen's lawyer called the court and said she couldn't come. She was ill. My client was there, prepared for trial. We would add 2 full days in before this pandemic hit.
Thank you. Unless there's any further questions from the panel, doesn't appear there are any. Thank you both, Mr. McGraw and Ms. Graves, for your argument. I recognize